Hey folks, Scott Weingart, and this is the MCrit Podcast. Today on the podcast, we're doing Neph Madness. We're in the toxicology bracket, and we're doing extracorporeal therapies for poison. Now, you might be like, what the hell is that? What the hell is Neph Madness? What brackets, huh? So you're going to be joined. You're going to have some partners in listening, my emergency and critical care friends. There might be some nephrologists listening, because those crazy kidney folks, what they do every March, much akin to a basketball bracket, I think basketball is some sport or something, and people do things with it involving brackets. I don't know. I have no idea. But akin to that, they tell me that every March they get a bunch of people together and have a competition of sorts for medical education on nephrology and all things kidney. And what they do is they assign topics and then people vote on who's going to win within each of these topics. And then, you know, you face off against the winners of other topics and keep facing off. And then eventually there is a winner. And this is one of the entries. And this entry today is extracorporeal therapies for poisoning, which is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. It's the Venn diagram overlap between MCrit and the Neph folks is how to actually save a poison therapy with extracorporeal therapies. Now you might hear, extracorporeal therapies, that's exciting. That's ECMO, right? And I'm like, I thought the same thing when I first came across these recommendations. I was all excited. But no, alas, what they mean by extracorporeal is anything that is a machine that isn't ECMO in this case, though it would be an extracorporeal therapy, but they don't talk about that stuff. They talk about things like which modality of dialysis or things like plasma exchange. That's what they mean by extracorporeal. So don't get excited. But that's what we're going to talk about today is dialysis and other extracorporeal modalities for the poisoned patient. And I have three nephrologists, brilliant, brilliant folks. They will introduce themselves shortly to talk about this. And I had a lot of fun, and I think you will as well. Now, there's copious show notes, and one of our nephrologists was actually the one who wrote the blog entry for this, and that's Jorge, and you'll meet him. And so you could find that and all of the other things on the show notes for this episode. So you should check those out after or during listening to the show. One more thing I should mention. We're going to mention a bunch in the show, a group called X-Trip. And X-Trip is a group of nephrologists and toxicologists who have come together to put the best evidence-based recommendations for extracorporeal therapies for poison patients. So if you don't know about this group, you need to. And so check them out. Just search for X-Trip in the show notes and you'll get a link to all of their recommendations. This is a group you need to know about in emergency medicine, critical care, and nephrology. And we have one of the co-founders, Mark, who you'll meet in a second. He will tell you a little bit about it, but I just want to emphasize because it's so important. If you are not using the X-Trip recommendations, you need to be. I'm not taking any money from X-Trip. X-Trip doesn't give out any money. But I really, really am a huge fan of their work, and I want you to check them out. So before we jump in, real quick, I'm just going to do a plug for the Resus Leadership Academy because it's perfect. Because, of course, the ED folks want to hear this, but the nephrologists, this would be perfect for them as well. And what the RLA, the Resus Leadership Academy, is a virtual resuscitation fellowship. So I get a ton of people, they want to have additional training in resuscitation in acute critical care the first 24 hours, but they don't want to do an additional fellowship. They just want to get out there into the world and work. But they still want that training. They still want that knowledge base. They still want to be the leaders in their emergency department or hospital on resuscitation. And for those folks, the RLA is what you need because it's a one-year comprehensive curriculum. You're meeting with professors every month. You are doing a asynchronous curriculum, and you will discover that by the end, you're just the best person for all things resuscitation. So if you're interested in that, come to resusleadershipacademy.com. That's resusleadershipacademy.com. And with that, let's jump right into the show. All right. So then why don't we start with you, Elena, ladies first. Who are you and what do you do?
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you, Scott. And hi, everybody. I am Elena Cervantes. I am a clinical nephrologist at Hopkins. And I am also an executive member of Neph Madness. And this is me, and this is what I do.
All right, Mark.
Hi. So I'm a nephrologist, internist, and presently working in the Netherlands at the Poison Control Center here as a clinical toxicologist. So I mix and match a little bit. I'm also the co-founder of the X-Trip work group, and happy to be here.
All right. And Jorge.
Yeah, thank you. I am a transplant nephrology fellow at the National Institute of Medical Science and Nutrition, Salvador Subirán in Mexico City, where I also did my internal medicine residence and nephrology fellowship. I'm I'm also a nephrologist attending UCMA number 71 in Torreon, Coahuila, Mexico, where I was born and raised.
Oh, fantastic, man. And Elena, why are we all here? What are we here under the banner of?
Excellent. We are here to discuss a very interesting topic that involves all of us, which is toxicology. And this is one of our regions for this year for NEP Madness. I can explain a little bit of what is NEP Madness for our audience, but NEP Madness is a tournament. It has an educational initiative that is similar to March Madness. But in this case, we have, instead of having basketball teams competing against each other, we have nephrology topics competing against each other. And it's really meant to be educational. A lot of people read these and try to pick a winner. But we also have a background of experts, which are called the Blue Ribbon Panel, who will also discuss which of these topics really will advance our field forward. So that is how the winner is picked.
Love it. All right. Now, Mark, before we go into this, I want to hear a little bit about XTRIP, because I love XTRIP. I think it filled such a gap of really having evidence-based recommendations for extracorporeal therapies for toxicology. Tell us just a little bit about how it got started and the work you folks are doing.
There's obviously a long story to this. So I branched into nephrology, but always preferred acute care. And toxicology was always one of the elements that I preferred. It's one of the cases where if I get called at 3 o'clock in the morning, I do it with a smile. At some point, you start thinking, maybe there's something there. I should probably explore that. Did a few rotations in New York at Bellevue Toxicology and really confirmed that I was a failed toxicologist. And so try to bring both of those worlds together. And then you realize that in toxicology, it is a science. There are clinical toxicologists in the US and other countries, but the heterogeneity of what people do, and even within the same center, you take an example of salicylate poisoning, for example. One physician will use heavy dose of sodium bicarbonate, whereas somebody else will dialyze a patient very, very early on. And then at some point, you realize that there's a lot of opinions and there's no really conformity on what's the best way to treat these tox patients. And so I approached Valerie Levin, who's a very big epidemiologist right now. And I also approached Bob Hoffman, who is probably the best known clinical toxicologist in the world. And basically we said, guys, I think there's something there. There's a potential to bring together nephrologists, critical care physicians, a lot of pretty smart and enthusiastic people together. And let's review the literature and provide some opinions, look at the science, and provide recommendations for physicians out there.
Fantastic. And the work that's come out is amazing. And we're going to link to the recommendations page so that people can see all of the various poisons that have been already reviewed by the group. So what I wanted to do is, let's pretend we have a patient who has ingested something horrible, and we will just say for now that they've gone to the XTRIP page and it is a poison and a level that is recommended for extracorporeal therapy. So let's just take that as a baseline, because later on in the podcast, we're going to go into some specific agents and see if there's anything that differs there. But let's pretend it is a patient that needs some form of extracorporeal therapy for elimination. Let's talk about the logistics of each piece of this. What do you folks want to hear on when someone's making a consult in order to expedite the procedure? What makes you want to pull your hair out because, oh, come on, you don't have this piece of information? Let's just hear about that. Why don't we start with you, Jorge? What makes you really just your fingernails like digging into your skull as they're talking to you on the phone?
Thank you. First of all, we would like to hear the clinical characteristics of the patient. If they are in shock, if their urine output, and also the lab values. If there is the pH, bicarbonate, potassium. That's what we want to hear about when they consult us on the phone.
Is there any difference? Because many of these XTRIP recommendations really stratify the patients into a good kidney function and a poor kidney function. Does it matter if they have chronic kidney disease versus an acute hit to the kidneys from the toxin itself? Does that change your risk stratification at all? Mark?
Absolutely. It really depends on the poison. So things like calcium channel blockers, it's not really, it doesn't influence really our recommendations. But you take a medication like baclofen, for example, and baclofen is well known. It's one of those medications with methotrexate and a few others, where if you take one pill, you take 20 milligrams of baclofen and you have advanced kidney failure, you can die from it. You can become comatose and end up in the ER, unable to breathe, you need a ventilator, et cetera, et cetera. That same dose in a patient with normal kidney function would be pretty well tolerated. So it really depends, but obviously things like baclofen, things like gabapentin, 300 milligrams in a patient with advanced kidney failure is going to be not as well tolerated. And you other things like methotrexate is actually a pretty severe one, where there's always errors, prescriptions, patients with psoriasis, for example, that's pretty typical, where you're supposed to get 10 milligrams once a week, and that patient takes it every day, and the physician failed to notice that the patient had a very reduced GFR, that can mean serious problems with the patient. So yes, it's actually very crucial for some drugs. I'll just add that things like ethylene glycol, which was our latest recommendation, if you have acute or chronic kidney failure, that's going to be a problem, because ethylene glycol, if you're able to eliminate it by kidneys, you're going to have a better outcome than if you can't. So dialysis is going to be more of a urgent therapeutic if you have some kidney problems versus if you didn't.
Elena, what do you want to add to those two answers?
I just want to echo that it is complex to identify it, especially for you folks in the ER, right? They come and we would like to have a smaller gap. We would like to have an anion gap. And truth to be told, we may have the anion gap. We may have some part of the history. We may have history about the substance that is ingested. But the smaller gap, at least I would say for us, it takes time. It is not always ordered, but which that's something I would at least hear. Yes, we order a serum osmolality, and then we'll take it from there, but it doesn't come right away. So I hear
that. It's important that not to assume that on the end of the line, when we get that call as nephrologists, that we know exactly what we're doing, right? It's in my experience, when it comes to these cases, in the ER, you guys are way better than us in everything toxicology related. However, I think some ER physicians perhaps are not super comfortable with discussing about dialysis. Seems like a very invasive procedure, and I understand that. But on the other end of the line, and I'm talking for the nephrologist crowd here, if you call us at 3 o'clock in the morning with a valproic acid overdose and you give us a level, we can sound very confident over the phone, but trust me, we're running to our textbooks and reading up on it because we have no clue. There are really no experts in this field. They're partial experts. And I think extra what it does, it brings people together. That's what it does.
So I just want to emphasize that point. Oh, this is Future Weingart, by the way. The necessity for both people to be in the same mental model when calling a consult is absolutely key. And the nephrologists I work with are brilliant, brilliant. Some of them know about tox a lot. It's an area of interest, and some of them don't. It happens very infrequently. I'm sure it was on their boards, but then past that, if you're not actively pursuing this information, it kind of disappears and recommendations are changing. So when you get on the line, I really think you guys could come to the same mental model by if X-Trip has had a recommendation about this, that you both are on the same page about them. And that means, you might want to email it. You might want to call back after they have a chance to look, because that way you are sharing that same mental model. And so, just as we have some rare esoteric things in our field, it's the same thing for nephro. And, like I say, you might get someone on the line that, they are the tox mavens, but you might not. And so the X-Trip becomes the mutual language that I think brings together the emergency world through the lens of toxicology and the nephrology world. And it's just really a beautiful thing. So check them out. The recommendations from X-Trip for the poisons they have done are in the show notes. And for the ones they don't, then, sometimes it's really a discussion with the toxicologists and the nephro folks. And in that case, you might want to do a three-way conversation with the tox fellow, the tox attending, and the nephrologist and you. And then wait, again, everyone could be on the same page. All right, let's get back in. So funny you say that, Mark, because before I get on the line with any of these cases, I've already read the X-Trip executive summary. And then I speak to my nephrologist or the nephro fellow. I'm like, I'm sure, as you already know, what X-Trip has recommended for this, and then fill them in, because it lets both of us have the happy belief that we both knew this information prior to the immediate review, prior to the call. All right, that's fantastic. Let's talk about access, because this is a crucial bridge. It's got to get put in, obviously, or else we can't do any of these extracorporeal therapies. Most EDs, and I think most intensive care units that I've worked in, they really just stock one size of HD cath. That's what you're going to be working with. And so and we'll go around to all three of you. If you had your druthers and they did only stock one size, which size would you have them stocking and where would you have them put it? Most ED docs, they're just going to the groin. That's not my favorite spot to actually do CRRT from. I'd much prefer something in the IJ, but I want to hear from all of you. So what catheter would be ideal? And since you only get one catheter, where would you have them put it? Let's start with Mark again.
It really depends on who's putting the line and their comfort level. So it depends. In Montreal, for example, in where I work, it's the nephrologist who puts in the catheter. Yeah. And so we tend to be, in our institution, we tend to be a little bit more comfortable with the femoral line. And the femoral line doesn't require X-ray confirmation, especially at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. That could take a little bit more time. But the problem with the femoral route is that you're going to have a little bit more recirculation. So the technique itself is not as efficient as, for example, a jugular or subclavian vein line. So I tend to go with the femoral.
And what size catheter are you putting in?
I put in 20s. Okay. That's in centimeters. I don't know.
So it's like that in the US
right.
too. Yeah,
you're cool. Okay. Then. All right.
All right. So you're putting in a 20, 12 or 13 French, I imagine, in the groin. And now in the US, in the emergency department, and I think most ICUs, everyone has ultrasound and everyone is really well-versed with the placement of IJs. And the complication rate with ultrasound is virtually nil. In fact, the femoral complication rate is potentially higher because of the possibility of retroperitoneal bleeding, because people always use the ultrasound for IJs, but they have a tendency to just wing it for femorals. And that's problematic. And an arterial puncture is no fun either in these sick patients. Elena, what would be your druthers if they're like, what do you want me to put in? And you could ask for anything. What would it be?
Honestly, the access that can be there faster. So we want an access fast. And in theory, I agree, we would love IJs. They work better if we end up needing CRRT and, as Mark mentions, recirculation. But it may take time to get that one placed. So I prefer to have, again, I want an access that works and that I can use fast.
All right.
That answers the question.
Perfect. Any difference, Jorge?
I would go for an internal jugular vein, right? 20 centimeter catheter. But again, as Mark and Elena said, whatever can be faster. And here in Mexico, also, we also, as nephrologists, we are in charge of putting on the line. So whatever our experience is, it's better with right internal jugular vein.
Yeah, and it used to be people shied away from having anything in the atrium, but that actually is a fantastic position for your catheter tip for this. Hey folks, future Weingart here. For my emergency department listeners, you need to stock HD caths in the department. You can't have someone going up and trying to find them when you really need them. You need them in the department. The ones I stock, I have 12 French catheters. I stock a 16 centimeter for IJs and subclavians, and I stock a 20 centimeter for femoral. Now, if you only want to stock one, my belief is you should just stock a 16 centimeter, 12 French or 13 French dialysis catheter in the department. So that's first off, is you have to have the item, but then you have to know how to put it in. I received emails from my listeners saying, we have dialysis at our hospital. I have to transfer patients because I was never trained on how to place an HD cath. That's not good. It's awkward for the patient. You should totally learn how to place HD catheters. And it's a shame that the residencies don't teach this routinely. It needs to be taught. Now, the skills are not any more difficult than placing a introducer sheath for a trauma patient, for instance, but you're in a large dilator size. And that skill set is different. The skill set of large dilator use and placement, you really need someone to show you once or twice. I have a micro skills video you can watch on it, but if you really needed a course and couldn't find anything else, our Reanimate ECMO course, you know, just to put a plug in here, the thing I tell people is come to the course even if you're never going to do ECMO, because it will be no better experience than placing large catheters, you know, certainly bigger than a 12 French dialysis catheter. And if you learn that at the course, you will be absolutely fine for that, for percutaneous CHEPS tubes and pigtails, which also have enormous dilator sizes. So consider that, reanimatecourse.com, just to put in a plug. But we will teach you how to place an HD cath for sure, but you need to be able to do it. All right, let's get back into the show. Okay, so now we have access. Now, the next thing that most emergency departments don't think about, most of the ICUs I've in, they contemplated this necessity, but many rooms in the ED do not have hookups for dialysis. And the ones that do oftentimes are not the places that I actually want to resuscitate patients. You know, this is baffling to me that there's never been a discussion when, you know, because many of these EDs have been redone in the past 10 years and still no one has thought, maybe let's combine a resuscitation area and a space to take really sick patients and put them on HD. Have you folks found any problems with this? Are you dialyzing in like what is in essence a closet on these patients who are super sick, or are you doing most of your dialysis in these super sick patients in the ICU and then it's not an issue? And any problems that you've found with the actual logistics of hookups in your experience in these sick patients?
So I usually dialyze them in the ICU. I would give, there's one exception. It's the methanol poison case, that the patient that presents really early who's not sick yet, but I do want to remove a lot of that methanol. I might do that patient in the dialysis unit, but otherwise it's in the ICU. The problem is more how to do intermittent dialysis at 4 o'clock in the morning. The nephrologist sometimes doesn't want to come in. Sometimes it takes time to have a dialysis nurse. That really translates into delay, whereas in the ICU, a lot of ICU nurses can start CVVH or something equivalent much quicker. So it's really about what technique we can provide the quickest. And I always prefer intermittent dialysis, but unfortunately at night, sometimes it's way easier just from a logistics perspective to do CVVH, at least to start with CVVH.
All right. And we're going to get to the individual modality. So that's a perfect reference to that. Hey, future Weingart here. I just wanted to find some of these terms so you're not lost. Everyone knows, I think, what IHD is, right? That's intermittent hemodialysis. It's the most rapid. Things are going across a semipermeable membrane by diffusion is how you're going to have solute transport occur. CVVH, which is just mentioned, is a form of continuous renal replacement therapy. So instead of them getting an hour or two of something and then they're done, this goes around the clock. And this actually works by hemofiltration, which is solute drag across that semipermeable membrane. We have tons of fluid going out into a bucket, and solutes are dragged into that same place by that fluid movement across a membrane. And then we replace fluids at the same rate they're being lost. Unless we want to take fluid off, then we'll replace a little bit less than is being lost. And that's the difference between those two. Really, the difference in your mind right now is intermittent hemodialysis is rapid, but with the potential for larger hemodynamic changes, while CRRT or CVVH, the one particular modality that was just mentioned, it's slower. It doesn't have as much solute clearance, but it is in many cases more hemodynamically stable because things aren't happening as rapidly. There's something in the middle that we mentioned briefly in the podcast called SLED, which is slow, low efficiency dialysis, which is essentially a hybrid between the two. It's not as rapid as IHD, but it's not 24 hours. It's not around the clock like a CRRT, a continuous renal replacement therapy. And therefore, you know, it can be done by a separate set of dialysis nurses who could come in once in the course of the day for a few hours rather than having to have an ICU nurse running that around the clock. Okay, hopefully that fills in some gaps. Let's get back to the show. Elena, Jorge, anything in addition to that in terms of your location and any of the problems with the logistics of location? Are you guys doing it in the emergency department or are you also waiting for the ICU?
Waiting for ICU beds. I would say it's an unfortunate situation, but it's just real. We also need to make sure that the water supply that where we are able to provide dialysis is appropriate, and not all the ERs have the setup, as you're mentioning. So I think that's another limitation. So yep, ICU.
All right. Jorge?
I can only speak for the hospital I train on, but at the emergency department, we have some rooms that are adapted to give intermittent dialysis because most of the times the ICU is full. Yep. And after there's one free bed at the ICU, we just to the patient at the ICU.
Yep. Yeah, I think your place probably is reminiscent of the places I've worked at where, yeah, ICU bed sounds fantastic. That's not happening for 20 hours. So we got to do what we got to do. All right, let's talk about modalities, because for most of the X-Trip recommendations, and it makes complete sense, IHD is the rec because it's going to give us the fastest clearance of these toxins. But in a hemodynamically unstable patient, then we have to have a balance of which direction we want to go. If you had a patient, let's say they were, I don't know, like a sotalol or a atenolol overdose, and they're super sick, they're on vasopressors, would you still be recommending IHD for these patients, or would you shift to something like a CRRT or a SLED type situation? Why don't we go around? Mark, you start off, man.
It's important to distinguish these patients, because when we think about an unstable patient that we want to dialyze, historically, we think about septic patients. We think about post-op cardiac patients. And in those settings, it makes a lot of sense to prefer CVVH because you need to remove some fluid. And obviously, you can remove that fluid over 24 hours versus those 4 to 6 hours with intermittent techniques. However, in the tox patient, it's really not the same thing. You have to assume that this patient is not, first of all, that patient's not fluid overloaded, meaning you don't need to remove net fluid. So if you don't need to remove fluid, I would question why such a patient would be more unstable with intermittent dialysis versus CVVH, because you're not removing fluid. What you're just doing is filtering the blood. And of course, a lot more is coming out from that catheter, but the same amount is coming back in. And there are ways, as you can use vasopressors, you can put in some albumin to help limit this. But if your patient is unstable because of a drug, the quicker you remove that drug, the better it's going to be hemodynamically for that patient. And I think one of the better case that we see, if you have ever seen a patient with pure metformin overdose, metformin poisoning, these patients can have a pH of 6.7. Physiologically, it doesn't make any sense that these patients would survive. And they're on 4 vasopressors, and you start dialysis, and sometimes within 15, 20 minutes, you can wean all these vasopressors extremely quickly. If that's the same patient would be on CVVH, because clearance is a third or fourth what you would get with intermittent dialysis, these patients would probably be on vasopressors for an hour and a half, 2 hours sometimes. It's very rare that I would prefer, even on an unstable patient, that I would prefer CVVH.
That's interesting. And I want to hear from Elena and Jorge on this, because I agree with you. We're not going to be taking off any ultrafiltrate, obviously, in these super sick patients. And yet I have found IHD and hemodialysis in general, even on a CVVHD rather than CVVH, to generate instability. And I don't necessarily have an explanation for it, but I've just watched these patients crash and burn, even at SLED levels sometimes. And I'm curious about that. Elena, what's been your experience? Are you finding IHD is going to be stable in these super hemodynamically perturbed patients?
I think that here in the US, we are spoiled because we have CVVH, right? We have these continuous therapies, but there are parts of the world where they do hemodialysis on pressors for patients that are hemodynamically unstable. And yeah, I have one of my colleagues who is practicing in Bermuda, and she was just telling us that, yeah, they do it even for septic patients. So now if we extrapolate these to, yes, these patients that are presumably having an intoxication, we ideally want to do hemodialysis, but we are always tend to react with, but they are unstable, right? And this goes back to Mark's point. Sometimes we're not sure. And sometimes we end up doing hemodialysis on pressors for someone that has septic shock, because we may think that it may be metformin toxicity. But we try to do our best, I would say, and that internally that may happen, but it would be the ideal way to proceed, because we will not know unless we start removing that presumed toxin.
All right. Jorge, what do you have to add to that, man?
No, I completely agree with Mark and Elena. I think if the patient is unstable because of the poison, you need to remove it fast, and you will do that with IHD also. Sometimes continued kidney replacement therapy can be useful if you think the poison is going to rebound and the patient keeps unstable and they are not well tolerating the IHD. maybe you can consider that continuous kidney replacement therapy, but it will never be the first option in these patients.
Is there anything we could do, not on the medication management side, where you know the ED doc or intensivist is going to be obviously handling vasopressors, inotropes, et cetera. Is there anything that we could do with IHD to make it less hemodynamically unstable? Does temperature matter? Mark, you mentioned albumin. That might be a potential thing that we could add to the mix. What can we do to make IHD as stable as possible?
Temperature is a good one. The patient, if the patient can tolerate 35.5, I've even seen decreased dialysate, the patient's going to be a little bit better off. You also have a way of priming your circuit, which also helps, because if you don't prime the circuit, the first 400 cc's that goes into the machine, it's basically you've removed 400 cc's from the patient. And so it takes a little while for that 400 cc's per minute to come back. But otherwise, I would say to prime the patient, you can use albumin, vasopressors, temperature. And again, if you don't need to remove net fluid, sometimes it's a reflex. We're saying, hey, patients on the dialysis machine, let's remove a little bit. No, don't do that. And that's, I think, your best bet in these patients.
Fantastic. Elena, Jorge, anything to add?
Nothing to add. I just want to echo the temperature. That is the most effective intervention to decrease the hemodynamic effect of hemodialysis. So we definitely cool the machine. I was interested in hearing Mark about the priming. Here we prime everybody. So everybody gets 500 milliliters of usually saline. And that is the fluid or the volume that everybody gets removed. But I'm hearing you, Mark. I think that maybe in these patients that are intoxicated, don't even remove the priming. There's no need to remove any fluid whatsoever. Problem.
That I like that a lot. And the temp maybe is a key point for people to really hear, because do you think that most of the HD nurses choosing this temp on their own? Is this part of the prescription you give to the HD nurse? Is this relayed, or is this just, if you don't mention it, it's just going to get put at whatever their norm is?
This is a common error with tox patients. We tend to think of dialysis equals CKD or end-stage renal disease or whatever. These are patients who don't have a high potassium. These are patients who are not necessarily acidotic. These are patients, they're very different. And sometimes you even have to put in some phosphate in the dialysate, which is not a common reflex in these cases. Yeah, of course, if you don't get implicated in these cases and you let the nurse basically do her own prescription, that might be a problem. But that's why nephrologists need to be very much implicated in these cases and realize that we're not dealing with the same type of physiology and pathology.
Weingart jumping in here. I just want to review those steps for achieving the best possible hemodynamic stability during IHD, intermittent hemodialysis, in a critically ill patient. And number one is to prime the circuit, and then consider not removing that prime at the end, just running them at zero, even with the prime. Two is temp, lower temp, running the machine at something like 35 or 36 will achieve a higher level of hemodynamic stability, probably due to vasoconstriction and some other factors, but keeping the machine cold, the blood running through the machine, cooling during its passage will enhance hemodynamic stability. Three, consider albumin. Now, there is some evidence for this. It's not great evidence, but it has been my practice lately that if I have a patient who's hemodynamically unstable who they want to do IHD on, I will give them some high concentration albumin. I feel it makes a lot of sense, and there is some literature on this. And it's very akin in my mind to the same way when we do a large volume paracentesis, we want to give some albumin. Fluid shifts are what's leading to the hemodynamic instability, so it makes a lot of sense to treat them both the same way. And then four, obviously, is run them dry. Don't start, I want some ultrafiltrate as well. Unless you really feel the patient is precariously hemodynamically unstable and volume overloaded, if someone before you, they didn't realize it was a tox case and they were still in the old school of septic fluid resuscitation and they'd given this patient 6 liters of fluid, yeah, maybe take some fluid off, but otherwise, run them dry. Okay, so there you go. Those are the four recommendations for hemodynamic stability. That's interesting you mentioned that. So what is your dialysis choice in a patient with tox who does not obviously need any of their electrolytes controlled and might actually lose out from having the standard CKD prescription? So what is your dialysis choice?
potassium, you try to go for a physiological potassium. So K4, which represents the 4 mg/L, that's what you want to insert the patient. Of course, it really depends on the potassium of the patient. You might even consider it a little bit higher. If your patient's hypokalemic, for example, an acidic patient who's been on a sodium bicarbonate, who has an alkaline urine and is losing potassium there, you might want to actually give a little bit to the patient. You can bolus a patient during dialysis. People forget that, but you can absolutely do that. You tend to put in a high magnesium, especially you mentioned sotalol. You don't want a high magnesemia in these patients that can easily develop TERSAD. There's no common or exactly preferred. It really depends on the patient. It depends on also what the poison is, and you have to adapt it. So, of course, a patient with salicylate, because we know that a low pH in the serum, for example, is going to increase your likelihood of salicylate entry in CNS. So you really want to increase that pH a little bit to 7.5, for example, 7.55. We know that these patients do better when the pH is a little bit higher up. So I'm going to go with the maximum of the machine. Where I work in Montreal, that bicarbonate is going to be around 39 or 40. Sometimes it can go even a little bit higher.
Jorge, you did a really nice write-up for this to go along with this episode to enroll in the Neph Madness, and you mentioned a unicorn. I've heard about this mythical creature, but I've never actually seen it. Tell us a little bit about hemoperfusion and whether that has any real role in the management of these patients, because I don't even know if we have a charcoal filter anymore. So tell us a little bit about this.
Actually, it has been described in the literature of medicine, but personally, I don't have any experience on hemoperfusion. And actually, I don't think it plays a role in intoxicated patients for what I wrote, because it requires systemic anticoagulation. You have to change the cartridge every 2 hours. It's ineffective for the electrolyte and acid based problems we have, and also for fluid removal. We just said that most of our intoxicated patients may not need fluid removal, but they may present with electrolyte and acid-base imbalances. That's why we are giving an extracorporeal therapy to our patient. And the hemoperfusion, I think, doesn't play a clear role for intoxicated patients, at least for what the literature we have currently at this moment helps. And there have been case reports suggesting that they have some benefit, although it currently data, for me at least, is unconvincing for that.
Mark, do you even have charcoal cartridges anymore?
Yes, we do. I don't know exactly why. Historically, charcoal hemoperfusion, and there is one cartridge that is still available in the U.S. That's the Adsorba 300 cartridge, which costs about $600, so about 10 times more than the most efficient dialysis filter that we're going to have. And historically, it was really for carbamazepine, theophylline. We still see it a little bit. I've dialyzed 2 patients with theophylline overdose. There's a comeback a little bit. People are prescribing it for all kinds of reasons. But technically, based on papers from the 70s, hemoperfusion, charcoal hemoperfusion clearance that you could get with hemoperfusion were higher than what you could get with dialysis. But this is not true anymore, because dialyzers, the surface area is much greater. We can get much higher blood flows. Catheters are larger. So I really question why we would be using hemoperfusion. The only exception, if there were such a case of something that is highly protein bound, and when I'm talking over 90% with a low volume distribution, then I might, and a low endogenous clearance, I would consider using charcoal hemoperfusion. So something like quinine, potentially. But right now, there's not much place. And I know Cytosorb in the States is coming. There's some studies with septic patients because it supposedly removes cytokines. But again, I don't think there's any data related to poisons that would make me change my stance right now on the preference of hemoperfusion versus dialysis.
Elena, any hemoperfusion cases in your history? What's your stance on this?
No cases with hemoperfusion, but I'm actually curious with what Mark is saying, because I tend to think about another modality, which I guess we'll cover, which is therapeutic plasma exchange.
Yeah.
Which is really removing plasma and exchanging it for albumin or fresh frozen plasma. And I tend to think about this modality for those places that Mark was mentioned, right? That those that are highly protein bound, those that are very large, we tend to give these cut of more than 50,000 Daltons and with low volume of distribution. But is there any benefit in using plasma exchange versus these charcoal therapies, Mark?
This is a really good question. Unfortunately, therapeutic plasma exchange is not found in every center. I'm assuming all of you do have therapeutic plasma exchange, but they're only found in approximately 20% of centers. And we're just talking about Canada and the US right now. Outside of these, that proportion is even lower. It probably takes a lot more time to set up plasma exchange compared to dialysis. And the complication rate is a little bit higher with plasma exchange. You can have citrate toxicity, hypocalcemia, and probably the most importantly, the clearance. But in best case scenario, the best clearance you're going to get with therapeutic plasma exchange is something around 60 mLs per minute versus 300, 350 for hemoperfusion. Yeah, of course, if you don't have a charcoal cartridge and you would have it and you were faced with that kind of I would consider doing a therapeutic plasma exchange, but I've never done it in my life. And I've only done three, I think, hemoperfusion. And I remember all of them because they're a little bit stressful. You look at the platelet count, the glucose coming down, you start worrying, then you have to change that cartridge. It's a lot of hassle.
Jorge, you want to say something about this?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I agree with Lynn and Mark. At least here in Mexico, we don't have a hemoperfusion cartridge, at least not immediately available. That would be something very difficult to do here in Mexico.
Is there any toxin you could think of where it would be amenable to plasma exchange, but not to hemoperfusion? Or is it you pretty much just need one or another for a very few handful of toxins?
Just as Elena said, most of the toxins that can be removed with hemoperfusion, or at least we think we can remove them, they have high molecular weight, they are protein bound. So I think therapeutic plasma exchange would be better than hemoperfusion in that case, just as Max, avoiding the complications.
That's an interesting question, Scott. I think that's the question I would be asking my fellows. Name one poison that could be removed by plasma exchange and not by hemoperfusion. And I would probably think of a monoclonal antibody. Mm. So how often does it happen that we would remove them? But there are over 100,000 Daltons. And at that molecular weight, hemoperfusion is not going to remove them. So therapeutic plasma exchange, it would be your only modality, but how often do we consider doing that? Maybe a therapeutic error with a tenfold reduximab dose, maybe something like that, but otherwise not.
All right. Let's talk some specific poisons. Is there anything that you would want ED docs and intensivists to know beyond what they could read in the recommendations in X-TRIP? Let's start with you, Mark.
I would say the first thing is to initiate contact really quickly. These cases, for some reason, always occur at 2 o'clock in the morning. Call your nephrologist and mention that there might be a case so that the nephrologist has time to contact the nurse and to set up the machine so that we really minimize delays. Delays are what cause morbidity and mortality in solicited overdose. Sometimes that 1 or 2 hour delay can be very critical. So I would start there. And otherwise, we can mention a few other things, but and many antidotes. If you're going to use omeprazole, if you're going to use N-acetylcysteine, these all are antidotes that can be removed by the modality. So you have to increase dosages, but otherwise these are two things.
Yeah. I just to add to that, if you look at the X-TRIP recommendations, the patient does not meet criteria, still let the nephrologist know if the patient's super sick, because that might change 2 hours from now. And then they're like, why didn't I hear about this 2 hours ago? Elena, you have anything to add to this? What, any specific advice? You could hit individual toxins, poisons, or just general lifelong things you've learned that you want to relay to people.
I would say call poison control. Right now we have here Mark, who is our expert, right? But many times we're just like, oh, but did you talk to poison control? That is our first question, even as nephrology. So definitely call them first because they are very involved and they guide us really well.
Yeah, I'll add to that because that's a fantastic piece of advice is when you actually have a super sick patient and you call poison control, ask for this case to be related to the fellow because the original people that triage these are pharmacologists. And they're fantastic, but they're really there for screening parents who are scared that their kid had two Tylenol pills from the bottle. These super sick patients that have difficult decisions on extracorporeal therapies and what have you, it's really the toxicology fellow or attending who needs to hear about this case soon. And sometimes there's a delay. If you're calling poison control on a super sick patient, just say, can I speak to the fellow? And they will take down some demographic information and then they'll get you in touch with a toxicologist. Jorge, anything you want to add for advice?
I agree completely with what Mark and Elena said, early contact.
For any of you, what questions should I have asked that I did not?
There's always the question of, so it's relatively easy if you're faced with a toxin that has been reviewed by XTRIP, you just go on the website, take out our guidelines. There's a table summary that simplifies your task. But you need also a kind of an approach to how to approach dialysis. If it's a poison that hasn't been covered, and God knows there are thousands and thousands of, and what happens if you get called with something you've never heard of, should I consider dialysis? And we tend to jump, okay, what's the level? Because level is easy. It's a number. I can open up a textbook and look at the level. Is that scary or that? But there's a process. That process requires a consideration of, was it a toxic exposure? Are there things outside of dialysis that we can do? Antidotes, just supportive care. The patient that comes in, for example, with a baclofen overdose, we used to, and it was really interesting when we did that process of reviewing baclofen, because most of us were jumping at dialysis. We thought, hey, it's a dialyzable drug. It's not protein bound, doesn't have a large volume of distribution. It's the perfect thing to remove from the body. And of course, we're biased. We're nephrologists. We like to dialyze. But just really, we figured that a patient that comes into the ER is alive in the ER and that you can intubate and you can ventilate, that patient's probably going to do very well without dialysis. And let's not forget, dialysis has, there's a complication rate associated with dialysis. Of course, catheter, it's minimized with ultrasound. But a patient who's been on baclofen for years and suddenly took a really large dose, if you remove all the baclofen in the body, and that will happen after 5-6 hours, you're faced with another problem, which is often much worse than the acute poisoning. You have withdrawal. And if you've treated baclofen withdrawal in the ER, then these patients sometimes are stuck on a ventilator for days. And you've actually worsened the patient than if you hadn't done dialysis.
Anything, Elena, you want to add to?
I was going to say that obviously we want to know vital functions and also kidney injury, liver injury. That's another thing that sometimes pulls the trigger for some of the antidotes. So that's important. And again, I just want to echo this point of sometimes we don't know what is happening and we don't have the osmolar gap, but serial labs are important. And by serial, at least every 4 hours, that's what I would say. I am obviously curious to hear Mark and Jorge's experience, but I would say every 4 hours to monitor the trend of that gap. Is that growing? Should we pull the trigger on the antidote if we haven't yet?
Yeah, I'm putting on my intensivist hat. I would hope people are getting labs far more frequently than that. So you will definitely get at least your 4 hours, Elena.
There you go. Yes, thank you.
For sure. Mark, has there been any pushback, nephrology or toxicology, on any of the XTRIP guidelines? Which ones have been particularly contentious?
Everyone. It was a long-standing battle, especially for our first guidelines. The reason why, but not so much from nephrologists, to be very honest, because nephrologists were like, hey, we like guidelines. We understand what a guideline means. We understand that a recommendation is something that we probably should be doing, and a suggestion is something that we might be doing. And we understand, we're familiar with the level of recommendation, with the level of evidence. However, in toxicology, there was a lot of pushback. First of all, it's in my experience, toxicologists did not like to be told what to do because, yeah, but what happens if the patient has this or has that? Unfortunately, I've seen, and I've been on cases, unfortunately, I do also medical malpractice cases, and I've seen so many bad patients who have not been dialyzed and who died, probably would have done very well with treatment. And in court, for example, doctor says, yeah, there's no guideline. So I was free to do basically whatever I wanted. So there was some pushback and people didn't agree with the levels that we chose, didn't necessarily agree with. But I think at this point, people understand that it's just a framework, a reference to help you with these cases. Doesn't necessarily mean that if you don't comply, that you'll be in court 2 weeks from now. But it does give you a framework of how to approach these patients. And I think right now, most poison centers have integrated the extra guidelines. And if only for the research that is developed. So it's really interesting because with metformin, for example, lithium salicylate, there have been many publications that are looking at the value of these guidelines. What happens when these guidelines are not followed? What happens with the outcome of these patients? And I think this is wonderful. It just means that we're actually trying to debate, we're trying to verify if what we wrote makes some sense. And if only for that, I think it's been extremely positive.
All right. Fantastic. I cannot thank you all enough. This has been a true joy. What a wonderful way to start a day.
Awesome. Thank you so much. That was really fun.
Fantastic. Pleasure meeting you, Jorge.
All right.
All right. I hope you folks had as much fun listening to this as I did recording it. What a great group of folks. So check out the show notes, mcrit.org/370. Check out the X-Trip recommendations. Check out the rest of Neph Madness. If there's a possibility for it, vote for us if we did a good job. I think we did. So please, please, please vote for us. Let's see if we can win this bad boy. Before I depart, as always, at the end, I mentioned very briefly my physician executive coaching company, Medicine, where we help docs who have lost their flourishing at their job, or docs who want to move to the next level, or docs taking over a leadership role, or, and you know, I feel so bad, but docs who are being ousted from their job because of bad behavior. We could help all of those folks. If you're interested in that, come on over to mcrit.org/coaching. That's mcrit.org/coaching. This has been Scott Weingart for the MCrit podcast saying bye-bye. You hate that sound. I hate that sound. Why are you hearing that sound? You're hearing that sound because you are a unpaid listener to MCrit, and yet this is one of those episodes where only the team members, the MCrit members, get the full episode, which means you're missing out on tons of resuscitative goodness. You're missing out on the optimal way to care for your super sick patients. And it's sad because just going to mcrit.org/join would allow you to get full access, to get access to the RAC literature reviews, full episodes, extra goodies, bonus stuff, for an incredibly inexpensive price. Your department will pay for it, or you could write it off on your taxes. You could get it done before the end of the year and become a full MCrit member. Just go on over to mcrit.org/join, and you will now be someone exposed to all of the information to take care of your super sick patients that you want. You'll get this full episode and be able to actually perform a retrograde intubation. You'll be happy. So just go on over to mcrit.org/join and never hear this message again.